In the course of time, modern man has taken a rather blasé attitude toward the universe of which he is so intimately a part. We look out around us upon the most extraordinary and miraculous of worlds, and yet we are scarcely astonished. Everything has gradually been deprived of its overtones. Children have much of wonder in them, but as we grow older, this wonder ceases, and a kind of glibness takes its place. We do not have the answers to most of the questions that we ask, yet we are not inclined to leave very much sentiment in ourselves toward this world and its wonders. We look upon the universe as a vast environment full of energies and elements, essences, substances. But then we have transformed the world in which we live into a kind of cosmic laboratory. The universe exists very largely to be explored and to be conquered. We imagine it going on indefinitely through the infinities of space. We have a feeling that it must have begun sometime and probably will end sometime. Or if it doesn't end, it will change continuously. Vast cosmic suns will burn out in space and new worlds will be born. And man will continue the careful analysis of spectrums and try to solve the mysteries of cosmic rays and energies around him. Actually, however, we have lost the sense of the sublime. There is probably nothing that we can ever turn our gaze upon so splendid as the sky of night. Yet to us, it is merely an interference with the routines and rhythms of the day. We simply have lost this innate romanticism that made life a wonderful experience when we felt more and did not know so much. The ancients contemplating the universe had a thrill from it all, which we can hardly understand, which we are inclined to ridicule. To them, the universe was not just space and suns and moons and stars. The universe was a wonderland of living things. True, some of these things were beyond the ken of mortals. We could not see them. But our forefathers knew they were there just the same. And where vision left off, intuition took over. One of the earliest realizations of man searching to understand his world and himself was the kinship between the human estate and that of nature. Man, striving to understand himself, explored the universe, and striving to explore the universe, searched himself. There were certain parallels, certain analogies, which struck him at an early time. One of the most interesting and positive concepts about this arose, of course, in India, one of the old lands where religions and philosophies and sciences were mingled together in a magnificent extravaganza of metaphysical insight. The universe, obviously, was the body of a great being. This body had its own kind of bones, muscle, flesh, and tissue. We can only see a certain part of that body represented by planets and stars and luminaries. But we could also be aware of the great circulations going on within this fabric. We could sense an energy field enclosing all of these separate moving parts, tying them into an extraordinary functioning entity. And that this functioning entity was ensouled, our ancestors never doubted. That it was ensouled by a power capable of administering its infinite complexity, they were also satisfied. So to them, the universe was a living wonder, not something inanimate. It was not only living in the sense of being a vibratory mass of energies, it was living as having a mind and a heart. And in wisdom, men sought to understand the mind of this vast structure. And in religion, they sought to understand its emotional moods. Men who go down to the sea in ships have learned to accept the ocean as a creature of moods, something more than merely a mass of water. The more we are acquainted with these various elements, the more we respect them, the more we sense something of the tremendous intelligence that is locked within them. Our forefathers also assumed the universe to be ensouled with intelligence, that every part of its plan, every part of its purpose was motivated by wisdom, by some kind of knowledge. Whether it was rational or instinctive or intuitive, it was still there. This knowledge, this wisdom was purposed. All things were moving toward a destiny, towards an end or a goal that was known to something, or perhaps would be discovered by the very process of its own evolving motion. Also, our ancestors became acutely aware that nearly all physical things that we see around us, both in space and on our own planet, are actually the long shadows of laws. The universe is a vast network of regulations and rules, statutes and edicts, magnificent patterns by which all procedures are regulated. The universe is not actually a place of accidents or coincidences. It is a great, well-organized instrument, moving according to the laws of its kind, fulfilling its own purposes with an exactitude that transcends imagination. And as these laws operating throughout space cast their smaller shadows upon our own planet, we perceive that this planet also is controlled and directed by a legislative power coming from nature, coming from the heavens or from space itself. Actually, therefore, bodies are crystallizations along lines of law. The processes which are immutable create their own forms. And one of the first laws that man sensed in this magnificence was the law of continual and inevitable unfoldment. Everything is growing from some previous state to some future, a subsequent state. The whole procedure is as though a vast flower was opening in space. Slowly, methodically, inevitably, this blossom spreads its petals. Everything is releasing something from within itself in the process of its own growth. Thus we see that unfoldment guards or guides the ways of things. And this unfoldment applies to suns and cosmic centers just as surely as it applies to the maturing and development of human life. Man is unfolding. Man is not standing still. He is not a complete creature. He must tomorrow be more than he is today, even as today he is more than he was yesterday. The only reason for existence is this process of perpetual growth. A man observing this growth in his own experience was not forced to be too imaginative if he recognized it also in space around him. The problem as to where law came from, of course, also intrigued our forefathers. Those systems of philosophy and religion which postulated a deity at the source of life usually assumed that these laws were an expression of the divine will. Deity could be a despot, imposing its purposes upon its creation with inevitable finality. Deity could think what it willed. It could decide what it wished, and by the mere fact of its own divinity, could require its creation to abide by its pleasures or purposes or conclusions. This satisfied some early thinkers and satisfied Western man for a great many centuries, but there were certain inconsistencies in the concept. It seemed more reasonable to assume that in some way this world was not a despotism, that it was not ruled over by an arbitrary force. For if this force is truly arbitrary, then the thing that we are seeking most of all, the growth of things, would be frustrated. An absolute autocracy at the source of life would amount to predestination. It would end forever the free will of the creature. And if the creature is subject to the whims of an absolute autocracy, then moral responsibility is a fallacy. How can we be expected to be able to resist the edicts of an arbitrary deity? And how can we expect to develop character if we are constantly forced to follow certain procedures, whether we will or not? Thus we have the problem that worried Job, the problem of man's freedom to be himself. And in this freedom, finding the responsibility to be a better self each day. It therefore occurred to the more philosophic nations that the idea of a complete fatalism, ruled by an inevitable pattern of divine autocracy, with deity operating according to pleasure or displeasure and not according to value, that this could not be held as a basis for an integrated universe, that it is not reasonable to assume that deity could be partial to some peoples and neglectful of others, or that God could be subject to hate or whims of jealousy, or could be responsible for any type of evil, even though it were only the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. So it became a pattern in the ancient mind to contemplate the possibility that law preceded deity. The deity did not create laws, but administered them, much as in the case of the leader of a constitutional government, or even a constitutional monarchy. Nations have their bills of rights, their Magna Carta, or whatever may be held and cherished as the statement of the rights of the people. These various documents are served by governments, maintained by them, protected by them, but may not be destroyed by them. Thus the question arose, could law have come before the gods? And there are many ways in which this could be made to seem rationally possible. First of all, as we explained last week, we have to find some answer to the mystery of where the gods came from. And it might be easier to assume that they were products of law than to assume that they were spontaneous creations, something coming forth out of nothing. It might then be quite possible to assume that law, an immutable pattern, is intrinsic in the essential essences of existence. That laws like space and eternity and substance and essence and being have always existed. Therefore, that as long as the essential elements from which the world is fashioned are eternal, law can be co-eternal with these elements. For unless this is true, these elements could never change their relationships with each other and could never pass through the vast pageantries of creation which we behold when we study the stars. Therefore, the wise came to the conclusion that before gods and men there were laws. That these laws were the rules innate in all energies. That energies are self-governing. That all principles and patterns are self-maintaining. And that as surely as crystallization in rock or fission in cells, these take place with or without the consent of man or any arbitrary force that we know, simply because these processes are the right, natural, and inevitable procedures. Because this is true, then all existence is sustained by innate processes, invariable and utterly consistent. The universe itself is a manifestation of these laws in operation, just as surely as the frost picture on a window pane or the intricate geometric structure of a snowflake. These laws do not require the kind of theology with which we have been familiar. It would be rather difficult for us to imagine the anthropomorphic deity of our ancestors being much concerned with frost pictures or snow crystals. This deity seemed to be mostly involved in the miseries and misfortunes of mankind, spending part of his time saving his creation and the rest of his time wishing he'd never created it. This type of thing was not likely to advance the universal procedure. But if we assume that every substance has its own rules, and that these rules have always been, and that we know the substance today merely because it does obey its own rules, and that every element that we see is truly a symbol of a process, that all compounds are symbols of the elements which create them or produce them, and every form of growth around us is simply a law bursting into expression through its proper means and methods. It is because of such lawfulness that man himself has been able to compile a kind of index of natural laws. The wise from the beginning have been discovering laws. But they do not seem to realize that all of these laws are but evidences of something else. The magnificent archetypal totality, which can only be attained by all of these laws in operation, and must from the beginning express through the perfection of its laws whether its expressions are visible to us or not. If space is actually a vast area of lawful energies, then of course it follows that man's adjustment to space results from the gradual insight which he gains as to the operations of these laws. The alchemists of the Middle Ages pointed out that the Holy Scriptures were books which described lawful processes, and that nature itself was also an unfolding scripture in which all of the great edicts of the infinite were set forth in living characters. This attitude distinguished most ancient areas of thought. Man, becoming aware dimly that he does inhabit a universe which has rules, also recognizes that for some reason he alone seems to have the power to disobey rules. Now, perhaps he is wrong in this. It may be an arrogance of his own to assume that he can even be very wicked. But we do not see around us in nature as many rebellions against natural law as we find in man's nature. It therefore would appear to be that the most dangerous instrument a man's relationship with life is the human mind. Those creatures in which mental natures are not individualized never rebel against law, but fulfill it without question. Perhaps a few human beings who have come to a great insight into the mysteries of natural law have also verged toward this complete obedience. But for the majority, life is a resistance to this lawful pattern. The individual, seemingly convinced that he is able to defend himself and his own purposes against the infinite pressures of space around him. This is one of the points which we also find in Oriental philosophy. Sometimes Eastern thinkers are termed fatalistic simply because they assume that the individual is powerless to withstand universal purpose. Here in the West, however, we like to think that man is strong and universal purpose is either weak or non-existent. We have not yet learned enough by trial and error to realize where the error lies. We still assume that we have merely made some kind of a technical mistake which can be corrected in the next experiment. We are still attempting to exploit laws, to go against them, or to prove that we are superior to them, and therefore potential masters of space. Universal laws have many levels of manifestation. And we can find some examples of these levels or parallels to them in the study of the spectrum. Here we observe that one light, broken up prismatically, provides us with a complete spectrum of colors. Yet all these colors are invisibly held within the white light. And if all colors are imposed upon each other, we can also achieve what we call the no color, black. The problem that confronts many persons is to understand, if we can, how universal law breaks up into various parallel processes, each relating to a certain kind of life or manifestation. We do know, however, that as light is broken up to become colors, so the universal law pattern is broken into a mass of different parallel processes. We find law applicable to harmony and sound, to light and color. We find it in the octaves of chemicals. We find it also in the various technical arts and sciences which we are developing today. We find laws in language, in art and painting, in perspective, and in the various dimensions of dynamic proportion. We see laws in the canons of architecture. And we observe that if we break these laws, the resulting structure is not satisfactory. If we break the rules governing the processes of nature, these processes simply fail to fulfill themselves, or may turn upon us and endanger the individual who abuses them. If we build a house in defiance of architecture, it may fall and bury us in its rubble. Thus, everywhere, man experiences the need to discover the rules. There are laws governing even the simple trades of the carpenter and the stonemason. There are laws governing the professions, the methods of legislation and jurisprudence. Everywhere, experience has taught us that we have to set up rules. In old times, one of the first great codes that was given to man, the Code of Hammurabi, was said to have been revealed to the king by the deity Nebo, or Merodach. The likeness of the god was represented in the inscriptions at the beginning of the code. And in this code, Hammurabi sets forth his intuitive insight into the natural processes of human relationships. Actually, the laws of Hammurabi are still astonishingly just and extremely practical, although we have left them far behind in the complications of jurisprudence. But everywhere we have to find laws. And as we examine for them and catch up to them, or perceive them at least dimly in the abstract patterns of things, we have a new initiation into the universal plan. We become more aware that by using law constructively, all is possible. That the moment we use a law constructively or give it a lawful application that has not previously been generally known, we are actually contributing to the manifestation and evolution of that law process. The more laws we discover and obey, the more discoveries that we make through the cooperation with just laws, the more rapidly the whole universe unfolds its purpose. Thus man becomes truly a kind of priest in the temple of universal law. He serves the great statutes and edicts of his faith, and in doing so, also advances all lawful works in nature. These lawful works are brought out of darkness, out of caves, as Bacon said, and given their proper opportunity to be known in the light. and by being known in the light to be applied to the needs of living things. In space, many laws certainly exist, but again we are inclined to regard them all merely as we regard the light of the spectrum, as simply scientific facts. Certainly, life energies have to be present, but these life energies are simply force, or magnetism, or electricity, or atomic energy. We think of all these types of terms very glibly. We do not give them any clear moral value. The Egyptians and the Greeks and the Chinese, however, when they began to contemplate laws, they assumed that just as surely as a law by its own procedure established right and wrong, that somewhere in the pattern of things, this rightness and this wrongness must be regarded as moral equations. The simplest morality of the problem is that when you break the law either does not operate at all or it fights back at you. Thus, to do evil is to do contrary to the proper motion of the lawful purposes of things. To do wrong is to cross law in some way. And to cross law is to suffer. And suffer is punishment. Therefore, in nature, there is set up an absolute standard of right and wrong. And it is useless to assume that nature is amoral. It is not. It is moral because in the final analysis, morality is the use of energy. And the possibilities of use and abuse are clearly revealed in the very processes of using energy. It does not follow that you have to have a moral code of your own. It means that if you do not have such a code, your scientific process will reveal it through the very procedure you are following. And if for some reason you refuse to accept the moral implication of the experiment you are making, you will have an explosion in the laboratory, or something will go wrong, hazarding your own security or the success of the experiment. So that there is this good-bad factor. Good in this case being the advancement or cooperation of law. Bad being the failure of this advancement and the conflict with law. Now, the evidence is always present that in the conflict with law, man is conflicting with something so far beyond his understanding that he can never actually win. He can never change law. But law can always change him. In this battle, then, any attitude of his own which is inconsistent with the laws governing elements, substances, processes, values, any such inconsistency must lead to misfortune of some kind. The ancients, putting all these laws together, followed much in the concept of Sir James Jeans and came to the conclusion that somewhere at the seat of life, in the universe, in the cosmos, in space, was what might be termed universal intelligence. Universal intelligence does not mean a conscious universal deity. It does not mean that there is someone out there pondering upon the imponderables of existence. It does not mean that there is someone who is moving the pieces of a cosmic chess game. What is really implied is a permeating universal intelligence, an intelligence that is everywhere, in everything, and of everything, an intelligence which refuses to permit non-intelligence to be victorious in nature, an intelligence which causes all things to do that which is best and proper for themselves, unless a counterintelligence exists. And this counterintelligence seems to exist in man, but it is too feeble to hazard the outcome. It is not possible for man to go against this larger intelligence. Science, of course, can take the attitude, and has taken the attitude, that what is termed this universal over-intelligence is simply the habit of substances and processes. That these are habitual. Yet if we study the word habitual carefully enough, we will realize that habits, like every other substance in nature, are not self-creating. A habit, in order to exist, has to be cultivated in some way. A creature or a being has to do a certain thing a number of times repetitively before the habitual process sets in. Therefore, while it may appear at this time that laws are habits of space, we cannot assume necessarily from this that the habits themselves do not arise in some form of an intellectual or intelligible process. Man's habits certainly rise in the presence of his own intelligence, and there is no conflict between the concept of habit and the concept of intelligence, nor are they interchangeable terms. We must assume, consequently, that all the laws that operate in space bear witness to some kind of a legality, an orderliness, and that this orderliness is essentially constructive and purposed. That these laws also, relating to various elements, principles, processes, and conditions, are not brought into conflict with each other. And out of this vast pageantry of laws is brought the most completely harmonious instrument that we know, the cosmos. This does not mean that the cosmos never has an accident, but its rate is very low. For the most part, the cosmos is the most perfect integration of interrelated factors that we can possibly conceive. This must mean, therefore, that these laws progressing and expanding through space do not come into conflict with each other. Which brings us to another important thing. How is it possible for any mass of laws tossed into the seething cauldron of creation not to end in some kind of a witch's brew? How are we to explain that all these laws never conflict? We know that in a community in which we set up a few laws for mutual protection, these laws are always unjust to somebody. That the laws of a city may differ from those of a county, or of a state, or of the nation, bringing the most lamentable confusion. That the laws of various nations will permit a crime in one country and punish it in another. Also, that these various laws require constant amendments due to the fact that experience proves they are inadequate. And the great legislator of today is the forgotten failure of tomorrow. All of our legislations, and we are conscious beings, presumably, end in confusion. We create too many laws and cannot enforce them. Our laws, as one of the Greeks said, are like spider webs which catch small insects, but through which the greater criminal breaks and escapes. How does it happen that this is not true in space? How can laws relating to innumerably different qualities, energies, forces, and substances all apparently work together in a splendid pageantry of cooperation? The answer was rather quickly discovered by the Greeks. The reason why universal laws never conflict is because there is only one. And all so-called divisions and specializations are merely adaptations of one principle. There is only one law, manifesting one power, one quality, and one condition. But this is broken up in the processes of creation like the light upon the spectrum, giving the appearance of manyness, but not coming in conflict, because there is no conflict in the realities, only in the appearances. Thus, all laws are complementary because their purpose is the same, and they arise within a structure which has an overpower to control them all. Now, this overpower, again, is not the meddling finger of some arbitrary godling. The overpower is the totality, the unity of existence itself. Law, space, substance, mind. These are all names for one thing in different manifestations. The differences lie not in these things themselves, ultimately, but in the differentiating power of the mind trying to study them. The differences lie in us, in other words, not in the objects of our attention. Our own interpretations, our own emphases, cause us, like musicians playing upon a magnificent instrument, to produce from this instrument only the melodies that we intend, even though it may be capable of performing in all melodies and all harmonies. But we do realize that the reason why the universe does not collide with itself and perish in space is simply because the laws that govern it are in no conflict with each other, and that conflict arises from a sense of separateness or a power of division at the root of things. And in nature, this division does not actually exist. What we call division is merely specialization within unity. This is one of the principles expounded in Pythagorean arithmetic. These laws, however, also deal with various levels, and those levels which are in themselves different cannot come into collision any more than different qualities of matter or energy will come into collision. Collision is almost always the meeting of similars, and that which is similar will collide with that with which it is similar. But the Greeks pointed out that if you fill a basin with rock, small pebbles, until it will hold no more, you can still pour into this basin a great deal of sand, because the sand going into the spaces between the stones, because it is of different size units, does not come into any conflict with the stone. After you have the basin as full of sand as you can possibly fill it, you may then pour in several quarts of water. These quarts of water will be accepted and held in the basin because, again, they are different in quality from either the rock or the sand, and therefore can pass between the interstices of the sand. Thus we go on with various elements, Many things can be in the same place fulfilling their own laws as long as they are themselves of different qualities. There will be no conflict between them. Consequently, in nature, conflict is nearly always a thing resisting its own laws, whatever they may be. And such resistance is not common to be found in space itself. Space is forever moving with the magnificent sense of cooperation with things, rather than with the sense of competition. Assuming then now that we have a universe with all its laws, that we have recognized the possibility, as the ancients held, that this universe was eternal, that its laws were eternal, that its substances and essences were eternal, and its objectives are eternal, we are still now concerned to some degree with the relationship of the universe as consciousness to the universe as substance. Actually, substance and consciousness themselves are identical, but they represent two conditions of one eternal reality, or one eternal fact. These conditions are bridged by what the Gnosis calls emanations. The conditions of consciousness become more and more restricted, resulting in a descent of value. The elements of substance become more and more refined or attenuated or sublimated, causing an ascent of substance. And where consciousness descending and matter ascending finally meet, we have the point of junction or the point of control, wherein consciousness regains its positive relationship to matter or substance. Let's try to understand a little more on this particular theme. Consciousness, as we use the term today, must exist in space, or man could not be a conscious creature. The thought processes that we use must also exist, potentially at least, in every atom of space, or man could not have them. Thus we are dealing with a universe potentially conscious, potentially intelligent, and potentially endowed with all feelings, emotions, and sensory perceptions. These must be in the seed of things, even if they have not grown. Man is by no means the only product of space, nor is he the noblest. Therefore, there is every reason to assume that long before his advent, other forms of life had achieved consciousness, had achieved intelligence, and had released emotional and psychic content. This would mean, then, that there have to be powers superior to man, possessing intelligence. What are these powers? Some of the scriptural writers, particularly St. Paul, refers to the hierarchs, angels, archangels, thrones, dominions, principalities, and powers. These were regarded as great waves of superior life that had passed beyond our consciousness, but which belong to the same vast unfoldment of which we are a part. Science would not have had much luck trying to identify the archangelic hosts, but science is confronted with organisms or structures superior to man, which it has not been willing as yet to give much attention to in terms of consciousness. The most normal and immediate of these structures is a planet. Is a planet to be regarded as the production of an evolutionary process? We have our physical, astronomical interpretation of how planets come into being. But we are no more talking about planets in this respect than we are talking about men when we discuss the various developments of the fetus and the embryo. We are talking only about bodies. Science can explain bodies, but science is still having a very bad time trying to explain man as something separate from or superior to body. And many scientists have not yet made up their minds that man is separable from body. But science will admit that when the proper kind of a body is generated, something that passes for intelligence in humanity is also revealed or released. Perhaps we are a little optimistic as to the measure of this intelligence, but something capable of learning to read and write is produced, even though it may never be taught to read and write. That's another problem. Science, assuming, therefore, that a fortunate combination of processes produces a human body in which intelligence can develop, is in the presence of other fortunate combinations of elements from which planets have been produced. Now, planets cannot hardly be regarded merely as persons in the term that we use. But we have no reason or right to assume that intelligence depends utterly upon a peculiar type of structure which we denominate the genus Homo sapiens. There could be other kinds of creatures which could have intelligence as great as our own or even greater. If the intelligence of these other creatures was identical with our own, we would be able to interpret it. We would recognize it. And seeing something that thought the same way we did, we would say, here is another magnificent example of erudition. But if this other creature had a mentation process too low for us to estimate, we could not know it. Or if it was too high and went beyond the trivia with which we make up our intellectual lives, we would have also no way of recognizing it. If planets have intelligence, it is obvious their intelligence is not the same as that of man. Also, it is quite possible that many other creatures have intelligence. And the fact that these creatures are not favorably regarded by man as being subject to intellectual advancement does not change the possibility. For mentality can exist on different levels and planes. And an intelligence, for example, that is completely introverted, turned entirely within, might become a very great and luminous being. But man would have no way of estimating this unless the intelligence was released or reflected in common action which man understands. That is why Burbank was of the opinion that we underestimated plants, inasmuch as many of them have more sensory perceptions than man has. But their area of mentation is different. And that to us, which is different, is usually non-existent. Let us assume then that the intelligence of a planet is not the same as ours. That being a much vaster and more ancient organism and far more complex in its structure, we might assume that the planet was more highly evolved than an individual, and that therefore it might properly be appointed as the throne of a deity, as it was in Greece and Egypt, and even the star angels of the ancient Jews. If we want to say that a planet is more highly evolved, then all we are actually requiring to demonstrate this is a proof that the planet possesses superior intelligence. This proof is more or less forthcoming at any time we look for it. Actually, each planet has sustained its own evolutionary procedures. On each planet, forms of life develop. The lives of these developing species may extend into countless ages. Most recent investigation indicates that man has been here as a recognized species for at least 15 million years. Therefore, the Earth produces from itself. Not only does it produce forms of life from itself, but it also radiates from its own nature electrical and magnetic fields, which can likewise be estimated. And certain phases of electrical and magnetic activity can be determined or noted through the aurora borealis and the aurora australis. These energy fields of the planet can only exist if the planet is alive. Nor can these energy fields be assumed to merely be an essence permeating the planet. For essences permeating the planet do not take upon themselves organized forms any more than essences permeating the human body, but in no way directly associated with it could produce the specialized structure which we have in man. These essences have to be tied to a pattern, and they have to be evolving through a pattern in order to be effective or knowable or recognizable by us. I think then we must assume, and will ultimately prove to scientific satisfaction, that planets are beings, that they are, as Plato might have called them, huge animals crawling in space. Perhaps he was not as flattering as he should have been, because these are not just simply animals, they are godlings, if godlings can be seen. They represent tremendous centers of activity, mental and physical. Mental activity, because the life on each planet is as methodically laid out as in space.